All right. When we in Sunday's study, we covered the first chapter, and then towards the end of the first chapter, we James talks about being hearers of the word. I mean, being doers of the word, not merely hearers. And as I've been going through and kind of setting up or thinking about that, it seems like that is actually kind of setting up several of the points that he's talking about here in chapters 2 and 3. Even in the chapter 4, he in verse 11 of chapter 4, he actually mentions about that if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. So even in there, he's talking about being a doer of the law. So it seems like this idea about being a doer of the law is kind of the main thing, or the thing that he's setting up at this point to focus in on. And all these points that we're going to be talking about tonight, starting at the tail end of chapter 1 that we talked about on Thursday. I mean, it's on Thursday, on Sunday. My cold has been trying to come back on me, so if I start saying something odd, just give me a high sign, and hopefully I'll catch it. But, you know, on Sunday's class, we talked about bridling our tongues and practicing pure and undefiled religion, and it's almost like those are two generic type things that today he's going to build on. Bridling our tongue there to... just understanding, you know, the need to be conscious of that, and then a pure and undefiled religion, looking after those who need our help, as well as keeping ourselves unstained from the world. And then he gets into some more detailed points from there. So let's pick up in verse 1. And let's see here, if I can get a volunteer to maybe read verse. Go ahead, James, if you could read 1 through, mind taking all the way down to 13? Yep. Thank you. All right. So, what's he? Okay, you know, he's talking about here, showing the first point, showing impartiality to all brethren, not showing playing favors between those who are rich and those who are poor, and everything. So, I picked out these verses here, and you may have seen some others, but at least based on those verses and others, if you saw them, what problems does he identify that are associated with showing partiality between rich and poor brethren? Is this something that when you look at these verses here that James just read through, that this is something that's just a, okay, not a good thing to do? Or is it something that's stronger than that? What are some of the things that we see in these verses, Robert?
Not out of favor, which we've seen numerous times, just because you're rich.
Okay. That's true, too. Any other thoughts or anything here? What are some of the things that he specifically brings out, like in verse 4? What are we doing when we make, when we show this partiality? Yeah. I don't think I set up the end. Yeah, I set them all up there. I was hoping I could step through them, but I forgot. But this is the thing about it. That first thing that he points out there, we make distinctions among ourselves, first of all. What's the problem in and of itself with making distinctions among ourselves in this way? Okay, one, we're going to be divided somewhat. Is there any distinction with God when he's looking at us? He's not a respecter of persons. Whether you're Jew, Greek, man, woman, slave, no, all that. There's no distinction with God, so who are we to start making those distinctions? when it comes to this. So, that's, the first thing that he mentioned, that we're making these distinctions among ourselves, and then, like I said, we become judges with these evil motives. We can't even get past this first verse that we're reading here, and we're already seeing this strong language that's associated with this. This is not a, even if this was the only thing that's mentioned, I don't think we could come away thinking that this is just a nonchalant type thing. This is not a good situation if we are making these kind of distinctions among ourselves. But he continues down in verse 6 or 7. We're dishonoring the poor man. We're blaspheming the fair name by which you've been called, because we're making these distinctions that God doesn't make. Verse 9, committing sin, and we're convicted by the law as transgressors. Okay, so if nothing else, that verse lays it out very plainly that this is more than just not a good thing to do. It's a sin. It's a transgression of law. Yeah, Sheldon. Then that when you get down to verses 12 and 13, at least in connection with this, we're going to talk more about 12 along the lines of what Sheldon was just talking about. But we're opening ourselves up to this merciless judgment here. We're not showing mercy. So we open ourselves up to being judged from God in a non-mercy manner, if you will. Did anybody see anything else? Go ahead, Nelson. Okay, I never really thought about it that way, but that's a great point. There is, like, okay, if Christ walked in the physical frame that he was, would he look like a rich man or a poor man? And I think you're right. He'd be much more, he'd be closer to the looking like the poor man, not the rich man, and everything here. So in that sense, we'll certainly be dishonoring and blaspheming him, as well as some of the other points. Robert, and then Debbie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is it part of our culture? Maybe not in the exact same way, but is there a thing there where it's easy for us to maybe fall into and not even realize we're falling into it? And everything here. See here. There was some. I saw a hand back there up first, and then Melly. So Nelson, then Melly.
I was just going to comment. I think on what Debbie was saying, it was surely part of Jewish culture to equate someone who had something bad happen to them as being sinful.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also part of the culture to compare a really, really wealthy person with a really, really godly person.
True. Yep, that's true. Yes, Millie.
Well, I was just thinking along the lines that Jim mentioned, because I've lived overseas for a long time, longer than I wanted. You do worship with people from a lot of countries, and we as Americans have bad habits of walking in with our mouths open. And other people, I mean, we really have to work on this in Germany. And telling people, we're not the bosses
okay,
of the Church of Christ in Mainz, Germany. It's hard sometimes, actually, because people are so used to
mm-hmm.
giving way. Americans do have more money, and they do when they're over there. It goes both ways. It's a really a balancing act that you're working on all the time.
Yeah.
That you're all the same.
That's it. Oh. So that's the thing here is like I appreciate, you know, that example and others that we're talking about. It's like this is not something that's unique to their culture or anything. I mean they had maybe some unique aspects, and if you go to India, I know there's some things there that they're still trying to overcome a little bit. You know, the caste system maybe technically is gone, but there's still elements there when you talk to Jason or your dad.
Well, it's hard.
Yeah.
You want to see him honor.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, seriously?
Yeah. So.
And so it's both sides that have to work on it.
Actually, absolutely.
So.
Yeah, Glenn?
I think you're talking about among the brethren, but I think the same concept can apply when we think about our evangelism and we're thinking about, you know, who's a good candidate for evangelism. And we may sometimes judge someone as not being a good candidate.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because, and that's the thing, you know, we got to understand and just keep reminding ourselves, every soul is greater than us. And never lose sight of that. I think you're exactly right. It's so easy for us just, and that's part of what I was kind of moving to, like, it's easy for us to fall into it maybe without realizing it. I think that's one way that we fall into it without even realizing it. So, any others on that?
Probably don't move here because we only got that. You never know on a Wednesday night, you know. Sometimes we're all more brain dead than others because we've had rough days at work or whatever. So I appreciate that everybody's pretty alert tonight. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's go to the next question here. Continuing with this. I just had that thing about comparing James 2:5 with James 1:9. James 1:9 quickly. Saying, but let the brother of humble circumstances glory in his high position. We talked about that some on Sunday. So what are we failing to see when we shamefully treat that poor brother? You know, like I said, just read, and again, 2:5 is, listen, my beloved brethren, did not God choose the poor of the world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which he promised to those who love him? We kind of talked about this, but what are we, if we say that the poor kind of put them down a little bit and try to honor the rich people, what are we losing sight of here at this point now? Okay. Any other thoughts? Anything? I just had, you know, basically what their high position in verse 1:9, their high position, and then that they're rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom. What we talked about before, or just a few minutes ago here, is that, hey, where there's no distinction. We're all the same in the sight of God. We are all heirs to the same kingdom. We're all heirs to the same promise. Just because I may be poor or I may be rich doesn't mean I'm going to get a different promise or anything there. We're all heirs to the same thing as long as we are believers in Him. And that's in part what we're losing sight of there if we start making these distinctions. We're trying to, we're putting a higher thought to somebody else when in fact, hey, God's not given that. You know, the question, as far all God's concerned about is, are you a servant of His or not? How much money you have or cars or whatever, He doesn't care from that perspective. Okay? So, last thing here, last question on this is according to James 2:8 and then 12 and 13, what are the keys to ensuring we aren't showing this partiality? Verse 8 says, if, however, you're fulfilling the royal law according to the Scriptures, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. And then 12 and 13, so speak and act as those who are judged by the law of liberty, for judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. What keys do you see there in maybe overcoming the this partiality and not showing this partiality? That's a good way to put it. Just do what the Bible says and everything. In verse 8, you know, it talks about, did I see another hand there? I couldn't tell, somebody just scratching or something. But basically, you know, he talks, keep the royal law, love your neighbor as yourself. If you're worried about treating others the way you want to be treated, then you're going to take care of a lot of it right there. I'm going to take care of a lot of it right there if we just treat others like the way we want to be treated and not worrying about putting somebody higher than they should be or anything like that. But then also too, is like act as those who are being judged by the law of liberty. Earlier at the end of chapter 1 in verse 25, he talked about that the one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer but an effectual doer, this man shall be blessed in what he does. In other words, if you got somebody that's looking in at the law and allowing it to reflect back and seeing, am I doing what it says? Here's what it says to do, and I'm not doing it all. I'm falling short, and I'm making the corrections that are necessary to fill in those gaps. That's the effectual the doer of the word. And that's the thing here. If we're looking in at the word and it's saying, here's how to do it, kind of getting what Robert's saying, doing what the word says, allowing it to speak to us and treat each other the way it says to, then we're doing what it wants. We're doing the right thing there. So we make an application of that, but also too, just being humble. All this gets back to humility and meekness, to where we're not worried about judging others or anything there. We're just worried about doing what's best for our brothers, our sisters, and living our lives the way Christ wants us to, and just realizing that, hey, we're all the same in the sight of God. We're all in the same boat. We're all needed the grace of God, and going from there. Okay. Any other thoughts or anything on this section before we move over to faith and works? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, no, I appreciate the thoughts there. Okay, let's go ahead and move forward to faith and works. 14:14-26 of chapter 2. Let's see here. Who would like to read that? Any volunteer on that here? You want to do it, Nelson? Okay. Okay.
What use is it, my brother, if someone says he has faith but he has no works? Can the faith save him? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm and be filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. But someone may well say, you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith and your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. If you believe that God is one, you do well. The demons also believe and shudder. But are you willing to recognize, you foolish fellow, that faith without works is useless? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see that a man is justified by works, and not by faith alone. In the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works, when she received the messengers and sent them out to find another way? For just as the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead.
Okay. No, thanks for reading that. So, Jim, could you turn over to Titus chapter 2, verses 11 through 14? And in just a second here, we can read that along with this. Because first question I have here is the point of this discussion to do works to earn our salvation? And if that's not the case, then what is the point of this? And before we answer that, if you got that ready,
Titus 2, verses 11.
Thank you. All right. So, do you think that this point of this discussion on faith and works is to tell us, hey, we need to go out and do works to earn our salvation? Exactly. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to read that passage in Titus, because it starts out with, "For the grace of God has appeared to all men." That's where our hope is. We can't do enough works to earn our salvation. So that's not the point here. It's the grace of God that we have that. But what is the point of this? What's the point of works in this context? Go ahead, Robert.
That we have to have both works and faith to be truly
live by the Lord. Okay, right. And it's like the first bullet there was answering the first part, you know. So it's never lose sight of the grace of God when we're going into this discussion. But these works are the result of our faith, as you're getting at here. When, you know, we're going to be doing things because of our faith. When we're looking into that perfect law of liberty, it tells us to do certain things. It tells us to be there for our brethren. It tells us to help the poor when we can. It tells us to do a lot of things. So we're going to be doing things. We're going to be doing works as a result of our faith in God and His perfect law. Okay, just applying it and being effective doers. And everything here. So, this isn't cosmic or anything, but it's just amazing how, you know, these questions can come up with those that we're studying with or whatever. Yeah, Nelson?
And in the context of the rest of this writing, we'll call it a chapter, right?
Yeah.
In the context of this, I think it tells us, so when you're not showing partiality, you've got to get to know the people, and you have to meet each other's needs. And loving your neighbor isn't shaking their hands and blessing their heart. It's being ready to help and helping when you find out that they have a need.
Yeah, and that's exactly.
It's more than just lip service.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing here. The other reason why I pulled out that passage from Titus is, how did it end? It started off with the grace of God, which is what we need to remember. That's, you know, we have no hope without that. But at the end, it said that we are, in verse 14, he gave himself for us that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself a people of his own possession, zealous for good deeds or good works, depending on your translation. So, you know, that's what we're there for, okay?
Well, and just to go along with that, if I truly believe, and that's what he talks about here with Abraham and with Rahab, they believed it. And Hebrews tells us that Abraham figured that God could raise Isaac back up from the dead if he wanted to. We won't be able to not do that. If we really believe.
That's a great point. Any other thoughts there before we go to the next question? Yes, ma'am.
I think that everybody in the city of Jericho and Rahab told us why she said, we've heard about what God has done, and our hearts are melting within us like wax.
Yeah.
So the only thing that's even to be trembling is fear, right? We're all afraid, but there needs to be that extra part where they act.
Right. And everything here. And that's what we're going to talk about a little bit here when we get down to the next part. Well, not on this question. Yeah, there is. I can't read my own slides there. but yeah, when Rahab and all those, anybody in Jericho could have done what she did. But she's the one who took that next step and just said, hey, if I don't do something, I'm going to be destroyed. So she did something and everything there. So, but how do the examples of Abraham and Rahab illustrate the justification by works and not faith only that he talks about in verse 24? We kind of started already talking about that a little bit there, but what, you know, and if we just kind of carry that point a little bit, what is it that Abraham did? You know, it talks specifically about Isaac and everything there. He didn't just believe that God would raise him from the dead, but he went ahead and was like, okay, if God says I'm going to go ahead and kill him, and God will raise him from the dead. You know, we find out later if he wants to. But he knew that that was the son of promise. So he's like, I trust God that he will keep his promise. So somehow he's still going to be able to do that. He had convinced himself, okay, well, he's going to have me kill him, but he's going to raise him from the dead. Instead, he just didn't let it get that far. But he had already killed him in his heart because of his faith in God. He's like, he's still going to fulfill his promise to him. And Rahab saw her situation, knew that, hey, if I don't do anything, we know that this city is about to get destroyed because we've heard the stories. We heard what happened. That was 40 years earlier, and it still made the impression. That's the thing that's amazing to me. It's not like this happened last week. This happened 40 years earlier, and their hearts were still melted by it and everything here. So she knew, I got to do something. She saved herself from destruction because she put her faith in God that he could save her from that destruction. So that faith will always lead to action. And that's the key here. We can't just be hearers of the word. We've got to be doers. Which is the point that he was making at the end of chapter 1. Okay? But over in Romans 4, first part, starting in verse 1, says, "What then shall we say about that Abraham our forefather according to the flesh has found? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the Scripture say? And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Now to the one who works, his wage is not reckoned as a favor, but as what is due." Okay, so over in Romans we have Abraham not being justified by works. Over in James 2, we have Abraham being justified by works. Do these two passages contradict each other? And if not, why not? That's exactly what he's making the point of there, is that if you are doing, you know, if you're doing the work, you know, anything you earn from that is given because you earned it, not because it was as a favor, not because of grace. So the point in Romans 4, James, you're trying to say something else there, or were you just rubbing your chin? James is saying a lot of the same thing that Galatians is, but the question is on Romans. Romans is talking about not earning your salvation. That's what. So Abraham wasn't justified by works because he wasn't earning his salvation. He wasn't earning his justification. Whereas in James, we're talking about because of our faith and being doers of the word, we're going to do certain things. And all those things that we're doing are the things here to just like Galatians is talking about there, doing those things because we are Christians and we are followers of God and we're carrying out His work type of thing. So that's basically the thing there. It's just, again, I think we get that here, but that's questions that pop up. People will bring up because, you know, in both cases here, it's like, hey, it was reckoned to him for righteousness. And everything here, so it's like, how can it be the same? That's like, it's not, again, it's not rocket science, it's not cosmic, It's just, I say two different perspectives. It's actually two different points along the process, if you will. It's understanding we're saved by grace, not by works. In other words, we can't earn it. That grace of God, we accept it, and we look at His Word, and we believe what He says. And then, because of our belief and our faith, we do certain things, because His law says to do certain things. So it's that application. It's just, where are you in that process? All right, we're already 10 after, so the first bell's going to ring in just a second. Bridling our tongues. Quickly here, verses 1 through 12. Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we shall incur a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Now, if we put the bits into the horses' mouths so that they may obey us, we direct their entire body as well. Behold, the ships also, though they are so great and are driven by strong winds, are still directed by a very small rudder, wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. So also the tongue, it is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts great things. Behold, how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our life, and is set on fire by hell. For every species of beast and birds and reptiles and creatures of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by the human race. But no one can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come both blessings and cursings. My brethren, these things ought not to be this way. Does a fountain send out from the same opening both fresh and bitter water? Can a fig tree, my brethren, produce olives, or a vine produce figs? Neither can salt water produce fresh. Okay. We can start the discussion here, and we may just can pick up on Sunday where we'll get. But I just kind of find it interesting. You know, when you look at it, verses 1 and 2, kind of ask the question, how does that relate to this? We focus in on the bridling of the tongue. But he starts this off with, let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that that as such we shall incur a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many ways, and if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. How do those two verses relate to all this discussion about bridling the tongue and all the poison and stuff that he talks about there? I don't know if I have a great answer, Jim.
much of teaching is done through speech. So you have to be very careful what you say when you're teaching. So you're wrong.
I think that's a lot of it. Anybody got any other ideas or thoughts on how this is?
Okay. Because I think, you know, to me, when I look at it, I think it's kind of providing the context as to why he's bringing this up. He's talking about, you know, what I take from that, and if somebody's got a different take on this, I'm very open to it. But to me, it just seems like he's talking about the responsibility we accept as teachers for what we say or do. Like Jim was talking about there. You know, we got to be careful what we say, but it also reflects the need for a meek and humble attitude in what we're saying, and realize how much damage we can do with our tongues. Maybe in the context of as teachers, it of course applies across the board. But he starts this off with, you know, not all of you should wish to be teachers. Okay? From there, you know, how does James, throughout this passage from verse 5 through 12, how does he illustrate the power and danger of the tongue? Just looking through this. It's a small part, yet boasts great things. It is a fire, a world of iniquity. Do we have to almost go any further there? I mean, that's not getting very positive, is it? It can defile the entire body. Okay? sets on fire the course of our life, set on fire by hell. You know, at least that's the way my translation read. No one can tame the tongue. Restless, evil, full of deadly poison, can be the source of both blessings and cursings, and that's not the way it should be. So whenever he's going through this, he's laying out some really concerning things here to get our attention. And just to kind of sum that up here, since we're kind of out of time, you know, it's very strong language and everything, but I think one of the things I keyed in on was that third one from the bottom: no one can tame the tongue. It's not that right there. Some people will look at that and say, "Oh, well, I can," and find out they're wrong. Or we can look at it and accept it for what it says and realize we need to be very, very humble and take great care in the way we talk and the way we teach, and just realize the dangers that can be there. It's not saying don't speak, don't do anything, just accept the responsibility and be careful. Everything there, because if we treat it wrong or use it wrong, it can backfire on us big time. Okay? Any closing thoughts? Well, Sheldon's about to ring the bell. Okay. Thank you all very much. And we'll just kind of pick up after that passage, or right there. Well, man. Okay. I didn't get nearly as far.